Welcome to another episode of Compilator. This is a special episode because it's the first one in English. And the reason for that is we have our first English-speaking guest, Scott Henselman. Welcome to the show.
Hi, I apologize that I don't speak Swedish. I feel like I've failed you in some way. I could have come to this podcast and surprised you and started speaking fluent Swedish. But I'm afraid I didn't have time.
I would be awestruck.
That's my pleasure. I'm glad that you made an exception for an English-speaking guest. I'm happy to be here.
Very happy to have you here. So I would guess that the audience is like 50-50 .NET developers and 50 miscellaneous. Mm-hmm. I am guessing all .NET developers know who Scott Henselman is, but for the rest of the developers, could you tell us who is Scott Henselman?
Oh, that's very kind. I certainly am not keeping score as to how many people know that I am or not. I was actually joking with my friend in the speaker room here, because we're at DevSum here in Stockholm, and I was joking about how it's like being not a really famous person, like Tom Cruise, because Tom Cruise, he can't even go to the shops, right? It's more like being like a kind of medium actor on that show that maybe your parents watch, and you're like, oh, you're that guy from that thing. What's his name? Oh, Henselman, yeah. Because you're not really famous. You're like tiny famous in one room for one day a year at a conference. You know what I mean? So I do open source at Microsoft. I speak at some conferences. I've been online for 20 plus years. So any kind of, quote, fame is just people recognize me from the internet. That's basically it. Internet famous is not real famous. But I work on open source and .NET, and I'm very passionate about making open source, changing Microsoft and making it more open source.
That's a very interesting topic, and we'll get back to that. Speaking of internet famous, I've seen videos where you open by Googling Scott and you were number one for a while and number two.
Yeah, you used to be able to Google for Scott and you'd find me because the internet was not very big and I was the Scott who had like blogged the most, right? If you Google for Henselman with one N, Henselman with two N's is a different Henselman. Then you can find me right away. But now there's like Scott brand toilet paper and there's Scott fly rods for fishing and these other Scots have come and take my throne as the Scott. So, and I think I'm number two page, second page or third page.
And now you're here in Stockholm at DevSum delivering the keynote. Could you tell us what was the keynote about?
Well, so someone was telling me that a keynote should be less about like code demos and things, which is what I like to do, and more like big thoughts and big ideas and things like that. And I'm very lucky to be the member of an open source DIY, do-it-yourself community that's called Artificial Pancreases, because I'm a type 1 diabetic, and we have created open source artificial pancreases. There's actually a number of them. Some of them run on phones, some of them run on Raspberry Pis and small devices. So I thought I would bring a little personal kind of note to DevSum. And I did a talk, a 1 hour talk. The first half, I explained kind of how diabetes works as a biological process in the body. And then the second part was, now that we understand how this works, could we create an open source hardware and software system by which to effectively create self-driving cars, except rather than driving cars, we're driving insulin pumps. So we're making a self-driving car for diabetics, and it makes my life a lot easier. I've been on an insulin pump for almost 20 years, and I've been using an open source artificial pancreas now for 3 years. I think I was one of the first couple of dozen people, and now we have like 7,000 people doing this.
That's probably the most intense version of eating your own dog food.
It's an interesting thing that you say that. I'm actually not just running an open source artificial pancreas, but I'm running a daily build of a branch of a pancreas. And I had a little bit of an issue with time zones just last night. It was easily solved, but there was a little confusion about the date on my phone not matching up with the date on the pump. And then, of course, we have a fail-safe in the product, in the open source project, to notice these things. So it saw that I had changed time zones, and it updated the time. But there's all kinds of little things like that. It's not really dangerous. It's just something to be aware of. Like, it's the equivalent of keeping your hands on the wheel. So I always keep my hands on the wheel if I'm driving a car. I always keep my hands on the wheel if I'm using an open source pancreas.
I mean, most of us work with code that might display a web page wrong, but this code can actually...
It could give you a pretty bad day.
Okay.
There haven't been any major bugs because a huge amount of work is spent with safeties. So, for example, the obvious issue would be overdose, right? Well, the pump itself has a maximum amount of insulin that it will allow you to get. So even if I were to hack the software or something to force the pump to deliver too much, the pump itself has a software of its own that's very kind of battle-tested. That's closed source because it came with the pump. It's the firmware of the pump. That has a maximum amount of insulin. Then the phone has many, many checks to find out how much insulin it's delivered. And it also uses the phone as the authoritative source. It's kind of like as if your body had an audit log. So I can actually look in the software, tell you what it's done over the last 24 hours. And if someone were to do something sneaky, I would see it in the audit log. So you could give me insulin theoretically and give me a bad day, but I could tell you exactly when it happened and how and why.
It's not internet connected, is it?
It is connected over a 900 megahertz radio frequency. So the pump is not internet connected and the glucose meter is not, but they are both local area networks, or let's call them personal area networks. So within about 20 or 30 meters of me, there is around the 900 megahertz radio frequency or RF spectrum, the waves are floating around me. So if you wanted to try to hurt me remotely, you'd have to get pretty close. I'd probably see you, and it would be better for you to just punch me in the nose than to go to all the work of trying to kill me with insulin.
So you mentioned in the intro that you work with open source in Microsoft.
Mm-hmm.
And I checked your LinkedIn, and you joined Microsoft in 2007.
Mm. Okay, 12 years.
Yeah, it was a very different Microsoft back then.
Yeah. Keep in mind that the cloud was just being thought about at that point. Microsoft hadn't decided to become an internet host yet. We were more focused on trying to get like IIS or the Internet Information Server at GoDaddy or different hosts like that. So Azure was just being conceived. Additionally, I think that Microsoft perceived open source as a threat because how can you make money and be a capitalist and also do open source? Certainly the open source community figured out long ago that you can either charge support contracts, you can do open source and have support, paid support, paid consulting, but also hosting. So once Azure came in, it was really about being able to, I like to say Microsoft wants your for loop. It doesn't matter what your for loop is written in. So you could say 10 years ago, well, Ruby on Rails was a threat to ASP.NET because Microsoft wouldn't make any money if you ran Ruby on Rails. But if you can host that in the cloud, then it doesn't matter if you run Django or Flask or ASP.NET or you know whatever makes you happy. You run Ruby on Rails, run it in Azure, we'll take money for your for loop. But I wasn't thinking about Azure when I joined. I was more interested in getting as much software to be open by default, because Microsoft in 2007 was closed by default. Every time we wanted to open source something, we had to ask permission. Now it's basically open by default, and if you want to make it closed, you have to ask permission.
So I remember reading Phil Hack's blog where he wrote about ASP.mvc. Mm-hmm. And that started like a little underground project?
Well, yes and no. So there's a legend that they like to tell that that Scott Guthrie wrote ASP.NET on an airplane on the way to something. As I recall, a gentleman named Elon Lipton worked with a number of people to make a prototype of it, and Phil Hack was there and a bunch of other folks. Then they gave it to Scott Guthrie, and he looked at it on an airplane on the way to somewhere. But it's cool to say that, you know, it was made on an airplane trip, which is fun. But I think it was really an answer to Ruby on Rails, because Ruby on Rails remains a really great model view controller web environment, and we were just kind of coming out of web forms, which still exists and is well supported, but web forms effectively hides the complexities of HTTP from the customer, from the developer. Ruby on Rails unapologetically let the customer think about HTTP. It embraced HTTP, particularly kind of restful, representational state transfer, get, post, put, delete type of verbs. So this was an opportunity to come up with another way, kind of a .NET on Nails. I thought that'd be a cool name, but they said no. kind of an environment. And what a great opportunity to also, while we're doing this experiment, open source it at the same time. So it was the first big foray into open source. Now, historians and older people and former Microsofties might say, well, this isn't the first time we open sourced something. True. However, most things that we had done before were what's called source opened. So for example, in 1991 or 92, you could get the Microsoft Foundation classes, MFC for C++. You could get the source. It wasn't really open source, it was source opened, where you couldn't feed back into it. There wasn't Git, there wasn't social coding, it wasn't sitting in a repository somewhere. So you could access the code and read the code for educational purposes, but to call it open source would be a little bit disingenuous. This was the first time that we took takebacks, where you give me effectively a diff or a pull request, and I say, all right, cool, your code is just as valuable as my code, whether you're an employee and I'm an employee or not.
And that was hosted on CodePlex, was mm-hmm. it called?
Yeah, CodePlex was our GitHub or our SourceForge during those initial times online. SourceForge wasn't really an appropriate place for it, so Microsoft wanted a place of their own. And CodePlex had a good run. It was a nice place for .NET and for Microsoft-related source code for a number of years. But certainly now GitHub or places like that, GitHub, GitLab, or where open source lives.
So was ASP.mvc, was that the starting point of this open source movement that culminated with open sourcing all of .NET?
I think that it is fair to say that ASP.NET MVC was the best start of that. One could also argue that things like MEF, MEF was another thing that was open source that was not necessarily related to ASP.NET MVC, was a dipping our toes in the water of open source. But the idea virus that spread started with MVC. It was successful. We had a number of times where we would open source it live on stage. There were times when myself and one of the Scots would hit publish live on stage, or Phil Hack would go announcing, and then you hit publish, and there you go. You can download the source code immediately. And then we said, well, if we're going to open source that, why don't we open source this and this and this, and then the Entity Framework, and then .NET Core itself, and the compiler, which is Roslyn, the C-sharp compiler, and then F-sharp, and on and on and on. The F-sharp community also deserves a huge amount of respect for the early work that they did in open source. They had a foundation. We have the F-sharp foundation. We have the .NET foundation. Mono, of course, is happening all the while, because Mono initially started as almost a vote of no confidence against .NET, because they were saying, here's another alternative .NET with a friendlier license. It's a clean room re-implementation of .NET. And now, fast forward to 2020 almost, we have .NET Framework, which is source opened. We have .NET Core, which is open source all the way to the metal. And we have Mono, which is open source all the way to the metal. And now we're going to merge them all kind of into one single open source .NET for everybody, which is going to be really nice. Away,
Jag skulle vilja ta tillfället i akt och tacka våra sponsorer. Det är tack vare dem som ni kan lyssna på Kompilator. Detta avsnitt presenteras av SPP, det hållbara pensionsbolaget. Med mig idag har jag Katarina Berg, chef för Digital Development, och Magnus Hermansson, senior utvecklare. Välkomna! Katarina, jag är nyfiken. Varför är det viktigt med ett hållbart pensionssparande?
För mig personligen är det viktigt att jag vet att jag kan gå i pension i en hållbar värld som finns kvar. Och då tycker jag, när vi sparar så långsiktigt som vi ändå gör med vårt pensionssparande, så är det jätteviktigt att det är ett hållbart sparande.
Magnus, vad skulle du säga är den stora fördelen med att jobba på SPP?
Förutom det viktigaste, att få jobba med spännande teknik och roliga uppdrag, upplever jag att det är en bra arbetsplats för mig som småbarnsförälder.
Aha, kan du ge ett exempel på det?
Ja, men det finns många likasinnande, och därmed så ökar ju förståelsen för hur min dag ser ut och hur jag ska få det att fungera.
Det lät ju väldigt bra. Vad jobbar du med nu?
Just nu har vi många JavaScript-klienter byggda i Angular som vi bygger om till React.
Hur ser det ut på backend-sidan?
Där jobbar vi med .NET uteslutande, Microsoft-stacken och SQL Server.
Katarina, jag har hört att ni söker förstärkning till Magnus. Kan inte du berätta mer om det?
Vi är ju mitt inne i en digitaliseringsresa som innebär att vi både automatiserar och bygger massa med nya tjänster till våra olika kundgrupper. Så vi har jättemycket roliga saker framför oss. Och vi söker ju folk som vill vara med på den resan.
Magnus, hur kommer det sig att du sökte jobb här på SPP?
Jo, jag hade två gamla kollegor som redan jobbade här, och de rekommenderade mig den här arbetsgivaren. Det är en trevlig plats att jobba på. Dessutom så är det förmånligt. Jag tycker till exempel om att vi har 38,5 timmes arbetsvecka.
Sen har vi ju såklart en bra tjänstepension och förmånlig föräldraförsäkring som ger ett föräldratillägg när man är föräldraledig. Och sen har vi en rad andra förmåner också.
Det lät ju fantastiskt bra. Ni som är intresserade av SPP kan gå till kompilator.se/SPP, så kommer ni direkt till Katarinas LinkedIn-profil.
It's amazing what the journey that Microsoft as a company has made as well. Mm-hmm. If I look back to 2007, then I mean, developers loved .NET. Mm-hmm. They were on speaking terms with Microsoft. But now developers love Microsoft.
I think people have figured out that, yes, Microsoft's a big, giant, multinational company. Yes, Microsoft has 100,000 people. Yes, Microsoft will and probably will again do something dumb. But there's a difference between doing something dumb and doing something that's evil, consciously focused on like trying to do damage. I'm sure that those people exist somewhere, but I've never been in a meeting in the developer division or any .NET related meetings where there's what I would call evil mustache twirling. You know, like in the cartoons where it's like, and then we will take over the world. Like, we just don't have those conversations. The conversations that happen are, is this the right thing for the customer? Can we make this happen? Is this appropriate? Is this ethical? Is this correct? If it wasn't, I wouldn't work there. And if we ever do something really evil, then I would leave. But I'm pretty happy with the amount of stuff that we have open source so far, including the Windows Terminal, by the way, which isn't .NET, but it's super cool, the new Windows Terminal, and it's all open source.
Can we talk a little about, because recent 3 to 4 years, I've fell in love with having a terminal for everything.
Sure, sure. Which one do you use?
I use Commander.
Okay, cool.
And it's nice, but the duct tape.
Sure, well, let me see if I can explain it, and you tell me what you think. Because I know that Console 2 exists, Commander, ConEmu, I am aware of, everyone's aware of. I actually had someone try to remind me of it on Twitter a couple of days ago, and I was like, I've been all about the alternative console lifestyle on Windows for many years, because we all agree that the standard Windows console sucks. But architecturally, we should talk about what's really the problem. The issue isn't cmd.exe, or I call it DOS but not DOS, or PowerShell, or the new Bash with WSL and Windows Subsystem for Linux. It's the console host. It's the square, the Chrome, if you will, that paints the text. One of the things that's fun to try is open up two console windows, regular ones, type dir/s to go and look through all your subdirectories, top to bottom. It's going to start a very long process where it starts spitting information out to the screen. Minimize one of them. Wait a few minutes, and then open up the one that was minimized, and you'll find that the directory that was spewing out all that text, the one that was minimized will be done, and the one that wasn't minimized will still be painting, because it's actually synchronous. It can only go as fast as it can paint out to the screen. That's an architectural problem that's 20, 30 years old. Doing things like, I remember when TrueType fonts became a thing, and then you could have TrueType fonts in your console. Simple things that people on Linux or Mac are used to, resizing the console, control scroll, are simply architecturally not really possible. So then folks like Commander, ConEmu, Console 2, and others did a clever thing where they would start a console, minimize it or hide the window, and then repaint their own thing on their own window. So when you kind of mentioned that it's a little bit hacky, what you're referring to is that there was no clean API by which you could see what was happening on the console, talk to it, and present an alternative view. So they've redone that whole thing, and they've come up with a pseudo console subsystem, the way that Unix people are kind of used to doing things, where I could talk to a pipe and see what's happening on screen, but not really what's on screen. I want to get the benefits of something like VT100, ANSI, Glyphs, font fallback, all the things that other people on other consoles have enjoyed. And frankly, Windows has slept on. We've just now woken up. So Windows Terminal isn't just a re-implementation of a terminal that a ConEmu or a Commander person will find, well, okay, this is not that nice of a terminal. It's the subsystem. It's the underlying rewrite of the architecture that's interesting. And those folks that are making those alternative consoles can still thrive if they build on the new underlying subsystem. So I hope that ConEmu and Commander do really, really cool stuff and make, and we have like a console wars, but in the most kind way, like a cooperative console wars.
Like a Nerf.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, where the projectiles don't hurt. And we're all doing things better. So to talk about that example of the DIR being fast when you minimize it, you can actually make your builds faster if they spit out lots of logs by minimizing it and then bringing it back on the old console. The new console is written entirely in C++. It's all native. It's using like DirectX and 3D rendering. It's using your GPU. And they've decoupled the work that's happening from the work that's happening on the screen. So imagine a console that does 1,000 frames a second, like a video game does. That's why you would want to use something like the Windows Terminal.
And basically the actual terminal is like a reference implementation.
I wouldn't say a reference implementation, but that's one way to put it. That's an interesting way to put it. I would say it's the good, solid default. They're going to then start to, it's open source, right? So pull requests are already coming in. I think they're going to want to have really advanced theming. It's going to be really, really pretty. I wouldn't say it's a reference because that implies that it's not super awesome and fully featured. I'm just saying that really amazing out there type stuff that other people haven't thought of, the Windows Terminal might be a little more conservative, but ConEmu and friends like that could go and do something maybe different or offer an alternative perspective on a console.
It's no secret that I modeled this podcast after Hansel Minutes. It's a great source of inspiration.
Thank you, sir. That's very flattering.
It's a great honor talking to you right now. And I started podcasting because I love talking to people about development. I started off with one episode a week, and I gotta admit, it was a bit stressful.
Yeah, it's hard work.
Yeah, and you do it every week for 700 episodes.
Yeah, I've never missed one.
That's incredibly impressive.
I do them ahead of time. Right now I have 10 episodes. We call it in the can, so ready to go. I don't usually have 10 episodes in the can. I usually have 2 or 3. I was lucky to, like, when I meet, like, sometimes you have a dry spell where you're like, oh, I have no one to talk to. And then sometimes you talk to four people in a week. And because I do all of my interviews remotely, fortunately we're here with your equipment and we're able to do this in person. When I do things remotely, I have what I think is pretty good sound quality. It's not perfect, but it's pretty darn good. Then I can talk to anyone anytime. So I spoke to someone in Australia at midnight, and that was last week. And then I spoke to someone in Europe, and I stayed up late, and then they woke up early in the morning. So I'm doing a lot of this stuff in my quote unquote spare time, which is when the children are asleep.
And you, before the show, you showed me also your process, and it's very automated.
Well, I want to do the fun bits, right? Like, for example, for folks who are listening to this podcast, there's been a couple of times where maybe I said something I didn't want to say, or you said something you didn't want to say. So then you pause, and then we wait, and then we start again, and you just gave yourself work. So that's a small piece of work. But then you have to add all those little paper cuts up. Certainly good quality audio can save you time, not misspeaking, not swearing, different things that would cause you to have to edit, having great notes. You've already planned this, so you wrote down all these great notes and you know exactly what you're going to talk about. But if you just showed up with no notes, it would be difficult to put together a solid show, and that would then cause you time in editing. And what I think a lot of people with podcasts do is they start out with this idea that they're just going to talk and this show's going to pop out the other end, and they forget that it's an hour of editing. And then you have to make the MP3 file, you have to level it, you have to put the ID3 tags in, you have a website, da-da-da-da-da-da. But you said at the very beginning that you did this podcast because you like talking to developers. So what can you do to optimize for the fun stuff, talking to developers, and automate out all the rest, leveling, editing, whatever? So it sounds like you're getting the right start because you have a virtual assistant that helps you do some of those things. But I would say if you can find a way to drop the raw audio into a folder, and then poof, an MP3 pops out of another folder some couple of days in the future. I'm very lucky to have a woman named Mandy Moore as my podcast producer. She has a show called Greater Than Code that talks about humans, the human side of developers, because humans are greater than code, and you should check that out. And Mandy has really automated my process that I have an input folder in Dropbox and an output folder in Dropbox. I put in pictures and notes and WAV files, and the MP3 pops out the other side. So it's a partnership, having a producer or a virtual assistant like you have, and coming up with a system that you can set up for them, because there's stuff that Mandy likes doing, and then there's stuff that she doesn't like doing. So like I wanted her to help me with something a couple of days ago, and she says, I don't have time for that. That's not the part of my job that I want to do. And I was like, okay, that's a good reminder. So then now I'm looking for ways to automate the show notes. Like I mention a link, and sometimes I'll get a complaint from a listener that says, oh, you forgot the link. So I'm like, I'm always thinking about how to improve that process. How do I make those links automated? Do I find them with AI? Do I make a way for a listener to give me the link and update the site? Could the site itself be updated by the community if I make a mistake? I'm always trying to think about stuff that would avoid me spending my entire Friday afternoon producing podcasts when I really would enjoy creating podcasts. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Just do the fun stuff.
Yeah. And that's selfish, right? I'm trying to selfishly do just the fun stuff. But like I know that you enjoy the equipment and the microphones and all of the fun stuff that makes it a really great sounding podcast. And the part that you don't like is probably the pressure to produce. Oh, man, I don't have a show this week, you know? And then what happens is a weekly show becomes a monthly show, becomes a yearly show. That's what happened to me and Rob Connery with This Developer's Life. The amount of post-production on that show was about 20 to 30 hours per hour of audio. It was a huge amount of work.
It sounds amazing, though.
Oh, it sounds like killer. It's one of the greatest things I was ever blessed enough to work on. But I also have a job, and I can't afford to take a day. We used to take vacation days off work and pair up to edit that show to make it sound so good. Unless we get a big giant sponsor to come and tell us to do that, it's kind of hard. I'm sure you're doing the same thing.
Well, it's been great talking to you, Scott. Thank you so much for let me go again.
Well, it's been great talking to you, Scott. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me.
Sure. I have an idea. Tell me how to pronounce this word. What is the name of the show?
Compilator.
Compilator.
Okay. It's compiler.
It sounds like Spanish a little bit, but it's Swedish.
A little.
Compilator?
Compilator.
Compilador. I'm just thinking in like Spanish. So I'm thinking about the way that I say, this has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week. Instead, we can say, this has been another episode of Compilador. We'll see you again next week. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thank you so much.
Du har lyssnat på ett avsnitt av Compilator, podcasten för dig som jobbar med utveckling. Du kan hitta tidigare sända avsnitt på compilator.se eller genom att söka på Compilator där du hittar dina podcasts. Compilator produceras av Bartek Tatkowski och BRTK Digital AB. Läs mer om oss på brtk.se.